Welcome to Body and Soul, a teaching ministry dedicated to accurately proclaiming the Word of God. I'm Dr. Samuel Abate. This program is brought to you by the Adonai Diabetes and Endocrinology Center of Wasilla, Alaska. Well, so far we've looked at what the Bible has to say about health and what it has to say about the science of cosmology. Let us next turn to those things that the Bible has to say about water on the earth. Perhaps one of the most interesting stories in U.S. naval history is the story of Matthew Fontaine Maury, who is considered to be the father of oceanography. His interest in oceanography stemmed from his reading of Psalm 8 as a young man. Let's read this psalm together. Beginning in verse 3, we read, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings, and you crown him with glory and majesty. You make him to rule over the works of your hands, and you have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heaven and the fish of the seas, whatever passes through the paths of the seas. O Yehovah, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth." Now the most important verse for our consideration today is verse 8, where he talks about the fish of the sea, whatever passes through the paths of the sea. Now in ancient times, when people looked out over the oceans, they just saw the waters. They thought that the oceans were like a very large lake. They did not have an understanding of the existence of currents in the ocean, or if they did perceive currents, they did not consider these to be consistent. They thought that they were perhaps just random organizations within the water, much the way we see clouds randomly organizing in the sky. As a young man, Matthew Maury grew up on a farm, but at about the age of 12, he had an accident where he fell out of a tree, injuring his back, making him no longer useful to work on his father's farm. Wanting the young man to be able to care for himself, though, the father determined that he would send him to school where young Matthew excelled. He excelled well enough that he got admitted to the Naval Academy and received his training there and began working in the Navy. Unfortunately, later after this, he had a second accident, and in this accident, his leg was run over by a stagecoach. This permanently injured his leg, making him unable to serve at sea. Now, what we're going to see here is an example of Romans 8, where we are told that all things work together for the good of those who love God. As a young man, he injured his back, which gave him the opportunity to receive an education. Now, as a military person, he was again injured, making him unfit to be able to serve at sea. What the Navy did, though, understanding his value to them, was they put him to work in the chart room. This was really a demotion for him, and this was not considered to be the place where somebody did a lot of useful work for the Navy. But when Maury got there, he saw the disarray of the navigation charts, and he worked with captains within the Navy that were going throughout the world to have them make careful notes about where they detected currents. And he assembled these then into very accurate maps, charting for them the paths in the sea that were predicted, that were identified in Psalm 8 and verse 8. This was of tremendous value to the Navy, and this was of tremendous value to commercial shipping. By identifying these currents, ships could avoid the lulls of no wind that often would stop their ships for days to weeks. It also allowed the Navy to move more rapidly around the world. It cut by days to weeks the times that it took to traverse the oceans, and Maury was considered to be second only to Benjamin Franklin during his time in terms of how highly he was regarded as a scientist. Staying with the oceans for a moment, let's look at Job chapter 38 and verse 16, where it is written, "Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? In Job chapter 38, God is having a conversation with Job because Job has questioned why God is doing the things in his life which he is doing. God's response to him is not to answer him, but instead to lay out why it is that Job, with a finite mind of a human being, would not be able to understand God's reasons for the things that he does do. Throughout the chapter, he asks him, you know, were you there when I created the world? Do you understand how animals came to be? Do you understand how the world works? And one of the things he challenges him with is he says, well, have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the depths? Well, of course, you could not walk in the recesses of the depths because the deeper you go in the water, the more the water pressure is upon you. And it has not been until very recent times that we've been able to build submarines that were strong enough to withstand the pressure of the seawater upon them. One of the interesting discoveries in the 1970s, however, using these submarines that were able to stand up to 6,000 pounds of pressure per square inch, is they actually saw and photographed springs in the bottoms of the oceans providing water to the ocean. Traditionally, the oceans are filled by rivers running off and entering into them. But we had never known, except for in the book of Job, the idea that there were actually springs that also fed water into the oceans. So again, in this very ancient book within the Bible, we find a truth about how the world works, which was not known until the 1970s. Another scientific understanding which we get from the Bible is that of the hydraulic cycle. The hydraulic cycle was first described in the year 1580 by Bernard Palissy. This is the cycle whereby waters evaporate from the surface of the earth, primarily from the oceans, are taken up into the atmosphere where they condense and then fall again on the earth as rain, as snow, and then those waters find their way back to the oceans. So we see this grand scheme of recycling that provides water for the earth and at the same time maintains the water levels of the ocean. We can find three places in the Bible where it speaks of this hydraulic cycle. In Isaiah chapter 55 and verse 10 we read, "For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth and making it bear and sprout, and furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater." So notice that in ancient biblical times, there was this understanding that the rain and the snow which came from heaven had a purpose. It had the purpose of watering the earth, of providing crops so that there would be seed in subsequent years to sow more fields, and that the grain that also came forth could be then used to make bread to feed us. In Psalm 135 and verse 7, it says, "He causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth." So here we have the notion of water finding its way into the clouds because the water evaporates. The water goes from a liquid state to a gaseous state and is able then to ascend where it condenses and falls again as rain. Finally, in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 7, we read, "All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again." So here Solomon is commenting on the fact that we have water that's forever flowing into the oceans, and yet the oceans are limited in their height, that they don't flood the lands. Similarly, he points out that the rivers, while constantly flowing downstream, never seem to run out of water. And again, this is because God created a world in which water would be recycled, that fresh water would fall upon the earth, give rise to agriculture, give rise to the food that men needed, and then would flow again into the sea, but yet the seas would not overflow. the salinity of the oceans would be maintained, and man would have the water that he needed. Again, this is stated in the Bible hundreds to thousands of years before it is described by man in science. One final issue concerning the seas comes from the book of Genesis and the account of Noah. This has to do with buoyancy and the dimensions of ships to give them stability. In Genesis chapter 6, verses 14 and 15, we read, "Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. You shall make the ark with rooms, and shall cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall make it: the length of the ark, 300 cubits, its breadth, 50 cubits, and its height, 30 cubits." What we find here is the formula for the dimensions. We see that the length of the vessel should be 10 times its height, and that the length of the vessel should be 6 times its width. When shipbuilders have studied the optimal dimensions of a vessel, they find that this formula, that the length is 10 times the height and 6 times the width, are the correct dimensions for giving a vessel its maximum buoyancy and its maximum stability. So when God is giving the dimensions of Noah for the ark, so that he would have a vessel that would survive a prolonged time of floating, he gives him the exact dimensions necessary for maximum buoyancy and stability. This kind of specificity cannot happen merely by chance. But again, we see God reaching through time and space to share with his people the information they need in order to survive. And by his obedience, Noah did save the human race. The final section of truths that we are going to talk about that are contained within the Bible as pertains to science have to do with the laws of physics. Let's start with the first law of thermodynamics. The first law of thermodynamics states that energy can neither be created nor destroyed, that the total amount of energy in the universe is constant. This is sometimes extended to also include mass, so that mass and energy cannot be created, they cannot be destroyed, but they can be interconverted. You can take a piece of wood and you can burn it, and the energy that mass contains is released as heat. And so we're turning then matter into energy. Well, let's look at Genesis 2:1 and see what this tells us about the first law of thermodynamics. In Genesis 2:1, we read, "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed and all of their vast array." We see that God completes his work of creation. Creation is not ongoing. The vast array of everything that would be created has been created, and it will be conserved. So energy and matter can be, as we said, converted from one into another. Another example of this is seen in the photosynthetic process. Plants take the energy of the sun, they combine it with the carbon dioxide that is found in the air, and they generate glucose. They generate the substance that they need to grow. And so later, we find that wood, coal, oil can be burned to give off the heat that came from the energy of the organic material that it took to form them. So ultimately then, the energy of the sunlight that created the organic matter that went into the wood, coal, and oil now becomes released as heat. So in this way, the total amount of energy in the universe does not change. It can be converted to mass. The mass can be converted back into energy. And this very complex law has been stated and is found within Genesis 2:1. The second law of thermodynamics states that entropy, which is another word for disorder or chaos, increases over time. You only need to look at your desk. You only need to look at your home to see that entropy, that is, chaos and disorder, increases over time. you may go through on Saturday morning and clean your house and put everything away and everything is neat and tidy and orderly. And after just a few hours or a couple of days, you find that entropy is once again one. Well, we find in Romans 8, this principle of entropy is articulated. In it, the Apostle Paul writes, "For the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subject to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjugated it, in hope that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God." What is he talking about here when he says that the creation was subject to futility? Well, in Genesis 3, with the fall of man, God cursed the earth. God cursed Adam and Eve. And the earth became subject to futility. It became a slave to corruption, meaning that things corrode. They grow old. They deteriorate over time. This was not the way it was originally in the Garden of Eden. God's creation was perfect. It was self-sustaining. It never grew old. It never broke down. We see further attestation to this principle of entropy in the book of Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, we read, "And you, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are works of your hands. They will perish, but you will remain, and they will become old like a garment." So here the writer is telling us, just like the clothing we wear, we see wears out over time. In the same way, the creation is wearing out over time. And when you talk to scientists, they'll say that ultimately the universe will suffer what they call a heat death. That right now there are parts of the universe that are hot, parts of the universe that are cold. But as we see, the heat of the sun dissipates over time. And over time, the entire universe will cool down to the point where no energy exists that can accomplish useful work. And just like a clock that the spring runs down, the earth and the universe will also run down. It will grow old like a garment. So as we said, the initial creation was free of entropy because it was free of sin. But Adam sinned, ushering in entropy and death as God's judgments for his disobedience. The good news, though, is that while the second law of thermodynamics applies to our current universe, that we are told in Revelation 21 that someday there will be a new heaven and a new earth, and that new heaven and new earth will be free of sin and therefore will be free of death and entropy, and men will not grow old and our bodies will not deteriorate and God's creation will not grow old and it will not deteriorate. We'll complete our discussion of physics by talking about electromagnetic radiation. We'll talk about the nature of light and then the nature of radio waves. In Job chapter 38, verses 19 to 20, and then verse 24, we read, Where is the way to the dwelling of light? In darkness, where is its place? That you may take it to its territory, and that you may discern the paths of its home. Where is the way of light is divided? Where is the way that light is divided? Now, what this is getting at is the fact that light is made up of photons. It isn't physical in the way that atoms are physical. Light is a particle that acts like a wave. It has a very unusual nature. Because of its lack of physicality, you cannot have a bag full of light. Electrons, protons, these are physical entities that you can find, you can locate, you can have them in a place. But light and darkness don't have that sort of physical nature. So God is asking Job, what do you really understand about things as basic as light and darkness? Do you not understand that there is no storage place for light, that darkness does not belong to a particular territory? By doing this, God is expressing to Job his lack of understanding. The other piece, which is very interesting, is in verse 24, where he asks Job, where is the way that light is divided? Until Sir Isaac Newton, it was always believed that light was a single entity. But Newton showed that by shining a light through a prism, that the white light could be divided into the seven colors of the spectrum. Again, thousands of years before Sir Isaac Newton, the Bible declared that light was able to be divided. God is pointing out to Job that he does not understand this, that he is not aware of it. But yet, we do learn later that God was correct, that light could be divided into its constituent parts, and the colors of the spectrum can be separated out through the use of a prism. In addition to showing an understanding of the nature of light, in the book of Job, we also see indications of radiomagnetic waves. In Job chapter 38 and verse 35, we read, "Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, 'Here we are'?" Well, this is a rather curious verse. First, you have to understand that the term lightnings here is used to encompass all forms of electromagnetic radiation. When light travels, when electromagnetic radiation travels, it travels at the speed of light. So when we hear about electromagnetic radiation moving like lightning, that actually is an accurate description of the way in which it works. We also know that electromagnetic radiation can be used to manifest speech. You're listening to this program over the radio. So we have radiation, electromagnetic radiation, traveling through the air, and literally you can hear me say, "Here I am." This property of electromagnetic radiation was not discovered until 1864 by Maxwell, when he discovered that electricity and light were two forms of the same entity. That's where we get the term electromagnetic radiation. And this movement of sound, this movement of data and information using electromagnetic radiation is in fact the basis of all modern telecommunications. And yet this was described in the book of Job thousands of years before our present day. So far from being at odds with science or standing in contrast to science, what we find is that the Bible speaks accurately when it speaks of science. It speaks accurately when describing issues related to the human body, when it describes issues related to cosmology, to the hydrologic cycle, and even to the laws of physics. How can this be? Well, the reason for this accuracy is that the God of the Bible, the God that authored the Bible, is the God of creation. He knows the body that he created. He knows the universe he created. He knows the earth and how it functions. And he understands the laws that he set up that would govern this world and would govern this universe. As Sir Francis Bacon said, God has in fact written two books, not just one. Of course, we are all familiar with the first book he wrote, namely Scripture, but he has written a second book called Creation. And we look to creation to understand how powerful he is, how great his mind and his wisdom are. But we also look to his creation because it reflects his character. We see in nature a God that is orderly. We see in nature a God that is consistent and who has laws that he has for us to follow, just as he has laws for the physical universe to follow. One of the scientists we talked about in our first session was Matthew Fontaine Maury, the father of oceanography. And in 1860, he made the following statement. He said, "The Bible is true, and science is true, and therefore each truth, if correctly read by the other, proves the truth of the other." So he is saying there need not be a contradiction between the Bible and science, but the one will confirm the other. The study of the cosmos showed the world to be round, showed the earth to travel in a circuit. The study of the body shows the importance of blood as a means of communication, as a means of transporting nutrients and oxygen and hormones. we see that the laws of thermodynamics are immutable, that they reflect the character of their creator. And finally, we saw how the hydrologic cycle replenished the earth with water, maintaining the oceans and nurturing the earth. So when we do find conflict between the Bible and science, let us not be proud. Let us say that we need to study further. We need to look for additional information. Much like archaeology, often initial scientific findings will seem to refute or be contradictory to the Bible. But with further study, we learn the Bible was right all along, and man's knowledge is limited and finite. Perhaps the greatest controversy of modern times is the issue of creation. Yet, if we are to look at it objectively, we can look at this world and say there is no way, given its complexity, given the interdependence of the various factors that need to be in place for the world to function efficiently and appropriately, that this earth could have evolved by chance. And looking at the complexity in nature, the complexity of our bodies, of the ecosystem, there is no way for these pieces to just have come together by random chance without an author, without a designer, without the input of an infallible, immense, unmeasurable mind who could organize it all, could coordinate it all, and who is involved with it on a daily basis to help maintain it running in an orderly fashion. This is why David in Psalm 8 says, "When I consider your heavens, the works of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, O Jehovah our Lord, how great is your name in all the earth." Truly God's creation is his first witness to us that he exists and loves us. Thank you for joining us today on Body and Soul. This program is brought to you by the Adonai Diabetes and Endocrinology Center of Wasilla, Alaska. You can listen to audio recordings of this program on our website at www.adecteam.org. That's A as in Apple, D as in David, E as in Echo, C as in Charlie, then the word team, TEAM.org. Click on the Spiritual Growth tab at the top of the homepage and then scroll down to the bottom of that page for our study materials. Written outlines and slide materials from this program are also posted there. We hope that this program has been a blessing to you, and we look forward to being with you again next time on Body and Soul.